Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a special bonus episode in our first season of Wild Wild Podcast. So we've just finished talking about Italians in space. And the reason that I wanted to do this was because I was inspired by a book called Science Fiction Italian Style, written by Matt Blake. And I'm very pleased to say that I have Matt Blake down the line and who's agreed to come onto the podcast to tell us why he loves Italian and European cinema so much. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with, I believe you started off writing in fanzines back in the 90s. And was that European film then? Has it always been European film for you?
It's always been European film. I don't know why. I guess back in the day, it's kind of, I think there was a whole kind of host of people of a similar inclination who back in the kind of dogger days of the video stores and so on, discovered these Italian and Spanish films and just kind of grew obsessed with them in the way that slightly nerdy, idiosyncratic people do. It was all kind of, post-apocalypse movies and horror movies that everyone got into. And there was a group of people and we all kind of met up quite a bit and saw each other and it was just good fun. It's always been Italian and Spanish.
I mean, they're just, although ironically they are very often ripping off other things, at the same time, they're just not really like anything else. Because once you've seen these, it's like a whole new world of stuff you've never seen before.
Yeah, it depends which ones you're watching.
Well, that's true.
It depends on the genre. It depends on the types of films. I mean, if you're talking the science fiction films, some of them are pretty carbon copy-ish, but slightly demented at the same time.
Yes.
if you're talking things like giallos or genres like that, the films have a very unique atmosphere and ambience, which I don't think you get anywhere else apart from, in some modern day kind of equivalents of them, which are, very classically, well done in a way, but they're also slightly soporific and they're slightly trance-like and some people have a real struggle with them. But if you get into them, there's nothing quite like them.
Yeah. So your first book, I believe, was The Eurospy Guide, which I think that's possibly still the book you're the best known for, isn't it?
Yeah, that did very well. So that one, I guess I'm quite happy to admit that I'm a bit of an obscurist. I don't have any urge to write about things that other people have written about at great length before. Mm. I can't imagine anything more boring than doing a book on Mario Bava. Because what's the point? Everyone's done it before and better. So I've always kind of gone to things that people haven't written about or looked into or done anything about. So when I did the fanzine, I kind of wrote about people like George Hilton, Anthony Steffen, who were starting to get better known at the time, but were still quite obscure.
Mm. Oh, and we should say, what was the fanzine called?
Oh, it was called The Cheese Plant. Don't ask me why. So, you know, random. I think I managed to sell up to about 50 copies at one point, which I was very impressed with. But, you know, it's good fun. It was back in the days of kind of, you know, stapling photocopied pieces of paper together in your bedroom. But yeah, so then I did a book, The US Spy Guide. I did that with a guy called David Deal, who's in the States. And that was just because I kind of, people heard that I was writing one and David was doing something at the same time in a similar area. And we said, let's join forces. That'll make life easier. So we just did it together. And the spy films, I got into the spy films. And again, you know, in those days, there weren't torrents, you know, not that we torrent. You had to get hold of these films from places. And I just ended up with quite a big collection of them and, you know, buying them from Greece and Holland and so on and so on. And then I knew other collectors and we'd all swap them over and so on. Yeah, the spy films, they were kind of fascinating. They're not very good, I'd say. I possibly shouldn't say that. There's no, you know, they're a strange genre because spy films aren't like Westerns. You know, the Italian Westerns, you can look at them and you can say there are some absolute classic Western films.
Yes.
I'd struggle to say there are some absolute classic Italian spy films. There's some decent ones and good ones, but not...
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Iconic.
No, they just didn't really, I guess partly they didn't travel all that well. And so they're not as, like the Westerns obviously did very well in their English language versions. But yeah, these tended to, they didn't always travel that far. Some of them did again, but.
Yeah, I don't know. They did pretty well. I mean, a lot of them did very well in kind of strange places, not so much here. So much, but in, you know, definitely in the Middle East and Africa, they are massive.
Right, okay.
So, you know, there's people like, I remember reading Giorgio Ardisson told a story about how he disembarked in somewhere like Libya from a plane and got absolutely mobbed by people who all knew him as James Bond. So they did get quite well seen. They were big money spinners, but they didn't have that. I mean, you know, they were kind of carbon copies of the West, the kind of, you know, American spy films and English spy films. They didn't get that Italian tinge to them, apart from in some subtle ways. I mean, I love the spy films, but they're not.
Yes, because they were often like sort of European co-productions, weren't they? So you'd get some German cast, some Spanish cast, some Italian cast, some French cast. Yeah. And the adventure that the spy goes on just depends on which countries are funding the film. So he might have to go and have an adventure in a bullring somewhere in Barcelona, and then he's got to jet off to Bruges or whatever. He's got to nip down to Rome.
Yeah,
it all just depends on where the money's coming from. I mean, your book, I actually used your book as part of my PhD because I was writing about the distribution of European popular cinema in the UK.
Yeah.
And so I ended up doing two chapters on Eurospy films. And so I persuaded the Sussex Library now has a copy of your book in it because I got them to buy one in.
I do hope every university library across England has a copy of the book.
Yeah.
I mean, well, but you're absolutely
definitely
right.
Got it in mind.
It's really interesting. It's something that people don't write about enough. When you're reading kind of books about film in general, but especially kind of like the Italian and the Spanish side, is the whole distribution side and the whole production side, which is fascinating in itself.
Yeah.
You know, the way the pre-sales of films, so that, you know, basically people were making films without having to make a profit most of the time. Anything they made was a lovely bonus.
Yeah.
But it's a whole art, and it's an area I would love to understand more about and do a bit more research into.
I was looking at, obviously there are so many that I just picked out a few key examples that I could use that I talked about the Agent 077 films.
Yeah.
Like From the Orient, From the Orient with Fury was actually the original title of my whole PhD.
Yeah.
Although I, I did change it later on, but that was one of the films. And also, what else did I use? OSS 117, the French era spy films. They're really good fun with Curly Matthews. I really like those.
Yep.
And also I picked up on a German one called Bonditis. Did you?
I reviewed that. Was it German or Swiss or something? I can't remember much about it.
Shot in Switzerland.
Yeah.
So yeah, they are good fun, but yeah, I think it's a fair point that they're not particularly memorable other than to people like us. Like they never caught on.
Yeah.
At the time they did okay, but people don't look back on them now. And they don't get DVD and Blu-ray releases now, like a lot of other cult films.
No, there was a spell back when I was kind of about 25, when I was writing the book, actually. I think one of the reasons it did so well was because of the timing. Because around the time that it came out, just a bit before, there was a bit of a lounge revival, you know, lounge core or whatever you want to call it, whereby suddenly all of these spy soundtracks got released. And it did go into a bit mainstream, so you had kind of lots of bands like Air and so on who were coming out, who were kind of digging out in the same kind of sounds that you got on the soundtracks. And that's one thing about the spy films I do love is the soundtracks, like the westerns. The soundtracks are awesome. And look, I don't want to do them down. I do love the spy films and I love watching them, and they're really good fun.
Of course.
But it's just, the western, the Italian western, the Italian giallo, the Italian crime film, they have films which I think are stand up in comparison to any films, full stop. Whereas the spy film, I don't think has that to the same extent. So.
No. But they are good fun and they're really fascinating to study as well. I think your book still remains the definitive text on the Eurospy, which must be nice.
Yeah, I do know Marco Giusti did a really good Italian language one. That's really good. He's got, you know, it's far better than I think my one was because it's got a lot more interview material and he knows all the people who made them. He's a very good writer.
Okay.
But not translated. I have at times thought about doing it again or doing a different one because I don't know how happy I am with that book, to be honest. Just because I think I know a lot more about the subject now than I did then. So,
an expanded volume then at some point in the future.
Maybe. It's one in the backlog, but the backlog has a lot of things in it.
True. So you mentioned Giorgio Ardisson. So you actually wrote a book specifically about him. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that called Giorgio Ardisson, the Italian James Bond?
Yeah. While doing the spy film book, I just got interested in lots of the kind of actors who are involved in it. And this guy, Giorgio Ardisson, I just got very into his films. Not so much. I mean, he's a decent actor. He's got a screen presence. He's good. But it was more the films he was in, which are really, you know, he epitomized the Italian popular cinema environment at the time in which he was working. You know, he started off in peplums, in quite good peplums, working with Bava and so on. He then became a massive star in these spy films. And was a very big kind of name in Italy for a short period. And then his career kind of, he did a couple of giallos, did a couple of cop thrillers, and his career just kind of, it didn't tail off exactly, but the films he made were reflective of the films that were being made in Italy as a whole. So in a way, his career is like a microcosm of the Italian film macrocosm, if you want to put it like that. Mm-hmm. And that's almost why I found him so fascinating. And then at the end, he made a whole bunch of films with people like Sergio Pastore, which are just completely bizarre. And that's another reason I got interested. So that was an interesting one. Again, like I say, I'm attracted to obscure subjects. You're never going to sell many copies of a book on Giorgio Ardisson. But I do know that he read it before he died. He was very happy that someone had written a book about it. So.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, people might know him as well for things like obviously Hercules in the Haunted World, which is a classic. I really like The Long Hair of Death, the Antonio Margheriti film. And he did Eric the Conqueror as well.
Yeah.
And also, I just noticed he's in Challenge the Devil, which is that what was previously a really obscure Christopher Lee film that just got released in a Severin box set. So people are discovering him again now in that one.
Yeah, absolutely. He also has a lovely thing which I love about him, which is he looks a little bit like the ex-Prime Minister John Major in certain things. So you're kind of watching a spy film with John Major, which is always entertaining.
There's a reference that our American listeners will have no idea who John Major is.
Wow. Yeah, look at a picture. Look at a picture comparing Giorgio Arditon and John Major. You'll get it.
I'm just picturing you've ruined his films for me now.
there's one he did, which is, I think it's far, far from his best, but it's one that I just have a particular loving for, where it's directed by Alfonso Brescia. I'm just trying to remember the name. And it's a Giallo where he plays an impressed husband who's obsessed with his fish, which he keeps in a fish tank. And he's oppressed and he ends up murdering his wife and carrying her body around in a suitcase all around Spain. And it's absolutely hilarious. I mean, Brescia didn't make one good film apart from this one, which is kind of unintentionally good.
Alfonso. Corpo. Your Sweet Body. I murder your sweet body, something like that. I'm trying to do it very, very, your sweet body to kill. That's the translation on the IMDb. My Italian is still very basic. Yeah, I mean Alfonso Brescia. We'll talk about him when we get to the sci-fi movies. But
what do we have to? Yeah. I know we like him, but
we've done two episodes on his film. So
I mean, someone's got to, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. You mentioned that he did kind of crime films as well, and I was interested. You did a book a few years ago called In the Name of the Law, Italian Crime Films. But when I saw that, I assumed it was going to be Poliziotteschi. But then you've actually kind of deliberately cut it off before the Poliziotteschi got into full swing, which is interesting.
There's a bit of a story in that one. So I
should just say you went from 1945 to 69.
So it was planned as the first in a series of books on Poliziotteschi. And then I was working on it, but at that point, Roberto Curti brought out his quite excellent book on the genre, in English,
the Italian crime filmography,
which is so good. You know, again, it's like I said about Barber, it's not worth my doing anything else on it, because it's been said. So, what more is there? Maybe at some point in the future, revisit it and do something else with it, but
that's interesting that you started in 1945. So would that have been loads of, like films like Ossessione and stuff like that?
So you can start with a lot of the neorealism films. They have elements of crime in there. Some of them are very pertinent today. I mean, a lot of the neorealism is a very bizarre genre. It's something that you're putting a kind of genre onto a group of films that are quite disparate in the first place. But something like, you know, Bitter Rice is the one that stands out to me, which is an absolutely brilliant film about, and you know, it's about, it is a crime film. It's got a kind of murder. It's got kind of it's got gangsters set in the rice picking, immigration kind of setting of the Po Valley. You know, it's a very, actually someone could remake it today and it would be quite an interesting film, but that is a crime film. So it's worth looking at. It's not a Poliziotteschi. But it's a crime film and they do blend into one another and there is a logical kind of timeline to them. The genre gets really interesting in the 60s though, and that's when you start getting things that you more associate with them, and you get what I refer to as kind of like the noir crime films, things like The Professional Killer and Assassination and Every Man Is My Enemy, which I absolutely adore those films. I love those kind of existential people driving around wearing sunglasses in big American cars kind of films, to a cool jazz soundtrack, of course. The plan was to then continue it and go into the grungy 70s and Thomas Millian and all of those. But yeah, not there's no point at the moment. And that's the point at which I thought, I'll try to do something different. I'll do science fiction. Who else is going to be mad enough to write about that?
Well, and that's, it's very true. I mean, it's, you are the only one, as far as I can tell, certainly the only person to have written about these films in English. And your book was actually recommended to me by, I think Rod mentioned it in an episode of one of his podcasts, because he does another podcast called The Bloody Pit, and they often cover Italian genre film, and I've talked on with their, with him on there before. Because I started a few years ago, actually, a blog on Antonio Margheriti, who is one of the, obviously, like the godfathers of Italian sci-fi. And we covered a few of his films there, and obviously talked about the Gamma One films and all of that stuff. So to discover then that there was a book published quite recently, I think I bought this during lockdown and read it quite quickly during lockdown, and was really fascinated that I thought I knew about Italian sci-fi, but then there are just tons of films that I'd never heard of. Yeah. And I mean, I was just amazed. I was amazed that you found copies of some of these movies that you talk about. And I mean, do you, because in my own search for some of the movies to do the podcast, it was a struggle to find some with English subtitles. Do you actually, are you getting these films and are you translating them yourself? Because you also, you're quoting from original reviews and things like, is Italian a language?
Yeah, so the original reviews, I have, how can I put it? I can just about read Italian.
Okay.
So I'm quite happy taking I'm quite happy taking interviews and things like that, which are relatively easy to translate. They're not too difficult. With Spanish films, on which we'll come later, I'm not so good at Spanish, but there's always the joy of Google Translate, which makes the life of a film researcher much easier. With Italian newspapers, and I do try and kind of include newspaper reviews when I can, Italian newspapers, translating from Italian newspapers is horrible, because the language used in Italian newspapers, it's like no one in Italy ever writes or speaks. It is absolutely horrible. It's so formalized and kind of weird that it's actually quite difficult translating. And I'm also not good enough at Italian to really understand it in spoken version, because it's a very different thing. So if their films, and a lot of stuff is compared to back in the day, in the, you know, kind of turn of the millennium, you couldn't see many of these films, but now the torrenting community and so on, they are, a lot of them are available in English or subtitles. I've also got quite used, and it's not the ideal way to doing it, but I did it with the spy book as well, to reviewing films while not understanding things that are going on and having kind of broad synopses which I understood, and watching them in a foreign language. And a lot of the time with B movies, you can kind of get away with it because you know, they're following a formula.
They're not particularly subtle.
No, exactly. And then there's some other films that you can get away with it because they're very visually based. Like a lot of the kind of dystopian science fiction films that came out of Italy, there's hardly any talking in them, so you don't really need to understand English to understand English helps, to understand Italian to get the gist of what's going on in them. But nowadays, most stuff you can get, the Spanish stuff, it was even more of a struggle to get stuff which is subtitled. Science fiction film is better.
And you've covered such a huge range of sort of subgenres within sci-fi. And I realized that you, about 10 years ago, you wrote a book about the fumetti. And that some of that ground has been recovered in this book as well. Is that right?
Yeah, that one sold out. So I thought, rather than redoing it as a book in itself, because it was a quite slim book, it was the first one I kind of did all myself rather than going for a publisher. I'd made that decision because I wasn't entirely happy with the spy one. I thought I could probably do it better. So that one sold out. So I thought, rather than redoing it, I'll just put in a chapter into here because it fits in science fiction.
They are all basically sci-fi, aren't they?
Well, there's one or two that kind of, I mean, a film like Criminal is an interesting one because it's a definitely, you know, it's very much a fumetti. It's one of the core fumetti films, but it actually it's more like a crime film. It's just that some dude is wearing a mask, and
that's true.
I think cover that. There's one or two which don't entirely fit in there, but you know, most of them do.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward. So what I did with the podcast, we just focused on specifically, we just picked out 10 films that were about Italians going into space. Yeah. And I think, but I'm definitely going to come back to the book for later seasons. I want to do a Fumetti season.
Yeah.
And we're going to do a post-apocalypse season.
Oh, yes.
But you've just got so many, even the really interesting ones, there's quite a few where you've got alien invasions. I mean, who knew that there were Italian alien invasion films?
I mean, there's not a huge amount, let's be honest, but there
just
are some.
Amazing. Yeah. All kinds of just stuff that we're very unfamiliar with. And obviously, there's, well, I mean, we may as well, let's get back to him now. So we mentioned before that we had done two Alfonso Brescia films. I mean, you, for your book, watched all five of his space movies.
Yeah.
Whereas I only watched two, although I found out later on that perhaps I could have picked a better one from the original four that I picked. But yeah, writing this book, there must have been times when you were regretting some of your choices.
Yeah, absolutely. No. It's very true. When you do find yourself watching, an Alfonso Brescia film in Italian without subtitles, you do think, what am I doing with my life? But then again, you could be watching Celebrity Bake Off.
That's true. Which my family are, as we record.
Indeed, so are mine.
We did Cosmos: War of the Planets, and then we did Beast in Space, which is, I think everybody says how terrible Beast in Space is, but after having watched Cosmos: War of the Planets, Beast in Space is like another level entirely. I appreciated it a lot more than if I'd just gone to that one first, I think.
It does help that Beast in Space is at least available in a decent DVD. So there's a big difference there. You're looking at something which looks immaculate, even though it's utter trash. And I don't know, maybe if Cosmos War of the Planets or one of the other masterpieces had a similar restoration project, it would come out looking just as pristine. Let's give him the advantage of doubt, shall we?
No. I mean, my favourite films, of the 10 that we just covered, I think my favourite actually was the last one we did, Escape from Galaxy 3.
Oh, my Lord.
I absolutely loved that film.
It
might be alone.
It's got camp value, that's for sure. Oh,
the costumes are incredible. The dialogue is hilarious. There's so much to enjoy with that movie. The fact that they just lifted all that stuff from Star Crash, as far as I can tell, without permission. I really enjoyed that one a lot.
Is that the one I've kind of forgotten? It's a long time since I reviewed it. Is that the one where it kind of suddenly veers into a kind of sex comedy towards the end?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because they land on Earth. And find themselves in the middle of a peplum film. Everyone's walking around with mini skirts. And they're in some kind of free love society where everyone just lies around having sex with each other.
That's the one, yeah.
And a couple of heroes have they don't know what sex is and they have to be taught. And it's really funny. I don't know if it was supposed to be a comedy or not, but I found it hilarious.
The disco
soundtrack as well is really, it's so contemporary. Oh, it's great.
Yeah. That was Vito Albertini, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he's always quite a reliably cheesy filmmaker. He kind of knew what he was doing. He was he wasn't completely inept.
No.
And his films tend to be mildly amusing, but slightly wrong at the same time.
Yeah. So that's, I should be thanking you. That's one film I don't think I would ever have watched if it wasn't in your book.
So I don't know how to take that.
it was really fascinating though to go right back. We started with The Day the Sky Exploded, which obviously where you started, and just see it was really interesting to cover. We did sort of 20 years of Italian sci-fi, and to see the way the genre developed, and it was quite serious to begin with, and then you get the kind of slightly Flash Gordon-y campness of the Margariti films, and then you get to the Star Wars ripoffs, and then whatever the hell Beast in Space is, And it was really fun to do that kind of journey.
Again, it does reflect the wider Italian film kind of journey as well. So you've got kind of like in the 60s, they're quite sporadic in the early 60s. And then they gain in force as kind of like a representation of kind of post-Godard kind of countercultural cinema that was popular at the time, which is pretty much unwatchable now. I mean, I'd rather watch a Brescia film again than most of the kind of like art house counterculture sci-fi films that were floating around in the late 60s, early 70s. And then it kind of...
I'm looking into the book now to see if I can spot an example of one of those.
Oh, man. Most of them never kind of made it out of Italy. They're terrible things. Tinto Brass did a couple. I'll put the names out of my mind now. Seed of Man is quite a good one. Marco Ferreri one. And there was a good one by Bruno Gaburo, which is called, I've forgotten the name of it. But yeah, a decent one of Bruno Gaburo with Philippe Leroy as well. What the hell is it called? That's going to really annoy me. I'm going to think of that and it'll come back. But there's one or two that are quite decent, but they're all very much bound up in that kind of, you know, it's all about, basically it's kind of student riots, it's hippies, it's kind of things going on, it's socking it to the man, and the man's, and mechanization is all automatic, all wrong. And it's a very idiosyncratic time. Such a lot of crap was talked and kind of made. And then kind of like the genre kind of went into the 70s and it became all big and glitzy and kind of Star Wars-ish in a very not very big and glitzy fashion.
I mean, the humanoid is amazing.
I count myself as being very rare in that I actually prefer Star Crash to Star Wars. give me Star Crash any day.
The film you're talking about, Bruno Gaburo, is Ecce Homo.
That's the one. That's a decent film. That's good. Again, I don't think it's English language, but again, there's not much language in it, full stop. And it's pretty much all filmed on one beach, so it was made for literally about £1,000. It's got a very good cast though. That's an interesting one, but some of those films are absolutely desperately pretentious. And then you've got the 80s sci-fi, where the whole genre and the whole Italian cinema is petering out, and it gets pretty desultory watching some of those. I mean, you're watching filmmakers like Romolo Guerrieri, who's a very competent filmmaker who made some excellent giallos and crime films. And he's driven to the depths of making, is it The Final Executioner, which is one of the worst of the post-apocalypse kind of movies. It is a bit sad in a way. But it is interesting. Sci-fi reflects cinema. Cinema reflects culture. You know, they all tie together.
It's really fascinating. And there are just obviously so many. I mean, originally when I was reading your sci-fi book, I was thinking I could do a podcast just on all the movies in this, and it would take me years to try and just to cover these. But then I started to think, well, actually, if I do that, there's loads of other Italian films as well that I like, and it's never ending. There are so many. Just you can never, no matter how hard you try. Well, at least for me, no matter how hard I try, I know I'm never going to watch them all. But I think you've watched a lot more of them than I have, so maybe it's possible for me to watch them all. You've moved away. You've mentioned this a couple of times. You've moved away from Italy for a little while, and you've actually written your latest book, just came out this year, is on Spanish cult cinema. Yeah. And I'm really fascinated by this because the book looks huge, like 300-odd pages.
And it's only for 5 years. Covered
four, 5 year period. So,
oh yes,
that's pretty amazing. I think in general, I mean, so again, speaking for myself, I think cult film fans are probably less familiar with cult Spanish cinema than Italian.
That's what I wanted to write it for, is because Spanish cinema is like a completely undiscovered territory, comparatively anyway. You know. there are a lot of Paul Nashe fans now, and he's quite well known. And there's, look, there's people who can write a lot better about Paul Nashe than I can, because they've done a lot of research into his life and talked to his family. And you know, there are people out there who can write a really good book about him.
And his films are getting a lot of Blu-ray traction.
Blu-ray, and I like Paul Nashe films. They're not my entire cup of tea, but I do like them. But like I say, there's other people who can tackle Paul Nashe a lot better than I can. And you know, Jesus Franco is quite well known, but you know, Steve Froer did Jesus Franco in much more depth than I could ever bear to.
I have to admit, I've tried Jess Franco numerous times, and I'm just not won over at all. No. I do like his, it's a bit like Woody Allen. I like his early ones, but his later, I like the early black and white kind of film noir, stuff like that. I really love those. But when he gets to the 70s and just goes insane, which is when most people seem to really switch on with Jess Franco, that's when I turned off.
No, I've got to say, I'm similar. I quite like a lot of his 60s stuff, although a lot of his worst tendencies are already there, the kind of meandering kind of plot lines and kind of strange kind of humorous bits which don't really work. And you know, part of the reason people love him is his kind of jazzy approach, which means he can go into some weird diversion which has nothing to do with anything else. And, that, you know, I get why people like it, but it's not really my thing. And by the time he's making films with Erwin Dietrich or two female spies with flowered panties or whatever it is,
that's not even a film I could have on the shelf in my house. I do really like The Awful Dr. Orloff and and you know, that period of his.
It's great. The Satanic Baron from Klaus is the one that I really like. That's the nearest English language title. I think it was released on DVD as The Satanic Baron from Klaus.
The Diabolical Dr. Zed is another
that's,
one.
That's decent.
So that bit of his career I'm down with, but
Yeah,
but so you meant, so which I guess is presumably in your book if you've covered those 4 years.
I did cover them. I do cover them. I haven't got to Nashe yet because it was 1960 to 64. So Nashe is kind of like something for the future, although he does pop up in supporting roles in a couple of films, often uncredited. Jesus Franco is actually he's quite a mainstream figure at that time as well. So he's not kind of like that wayward auteur that he's portrayed as. He's
working with Orson Welles and stuff around that period, isn't he?
Yeah, he's part of the cinematic. He's part of the cinema industry in Spain, slightly reluctantly, but he is at that point working in the same kind of industry structures and confines that all the other Spanish directors are. It's kind of. Look at him as something isolated from Spanish cinema and something apart from it in the 70s. He kind of strikes out on his own. But at that point, he was working with Spanish producers and you know, people like French producers, but Spanish primarily, and Spanish actors and Spanish filmmakers and Spanish technicians. So he was a Spanish director.
And like you said, even those early films do have their moments of this kind of jazzy style. Yeah. And the soundtracks are often very interesting. I remember one of them, I can't remember which one it was, I reviewed it for a magazine, and I described the soundtrack as being like a church organist was being attacked by a wasp.
Yeah, basically.
It's just like somebody just going absolutely mental on a church organ, and didn't necessarily fit with what we were seeing on screen. it kind of worked.
You could probably describe the scripts of most of his films as a writer being attacked by a wasp as well. But
that's true.
To be honest, but you know, that's why people love him, and that's people's taste. And you know, I admire Franco very much. I admire him as, you know, someone who got an awful lot of films made. That was his life, making films. He was obsessed with making films. He managed to do it. He made a massive number, and some of them are pretty good. He had a decent visual sense when he was able to, but he also, perhaps because he didn't like working with producers, he could be incredibly self-indulgent, and you know, that again is what some people like, because self-indulgent is, you know,
he's doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily
what we want to watch.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean the audience is the prime thing in his mind sometimes. But no. But yeah, I mean, look, he and at that time in 1964, he was a very interesting filmmaker, very good. But you know, those two, they are quite well known. But beyond that, Spanish cinema is totally obscure. Not many people, you know, a few people in the Western circles know a little bit about, you know, Joaquin Marchant or Joaquin Romero Marchant, who started making the kind of Westerns before Leone. But you've got a whole bunch of people. And in a way, this is something that interests me a bit about Italian film, is there's a whole bunch of people who kind of fall through the cracks because they're not necessarily kind of known in genre circles, and they're not necessarily known in the more reputable art house circles. And in Spain, there's a whole bunch of them who were very, very respected at the time, who no one in the English language world really knows anything about. Even people like kind of Berlanga and Bardem, who were Oscar winners and Oscar nominees for Spain. People in England don't remember any of these guys. You ask people, I think I say in the book, ask a bunch of cinephiles, get them in a room together, ask them to name Italian directors, and they'll come out with Bertolucci, Pasolini, Fellini, all of these guys trip off the tongue. Ask them to name French directors, and they'll have Roma, Godard, all of these guys, René, and so on, Renoir. Ask them to name a Spanish director, and they'll say Almodovar, and then they'll be a bit stumped, and they might come up with Carlos Saura. But, you know, Spain was the second biggest cinema industry after Italy at the time. It was really fascinating, really, you know, really interesting films being made. And in the first book, I go all into a genre called Cine Negro, which is basically crime films made in Italy in the early 60s. Kind of, I mean, Cine Negro basically means film noir, but they're equatable to kind of the crimis crossed with a film noir. And this is a genre that no one's really written about or looked into in Spain. Some of the films are really quite curious and interesting. It's a whole, like I say, it's a whole unexplored territory. And that's kind of what I quite like doing.
Yeah. And how easy was it, or difficult was it, to get copies of some of the films you wanted to write about?
Not as easy.
Was it a struggle?
Yeah, it was a struggle. And a lot of this stuff, especially from the early 60s, is not available. So you are having to watch it in Spanish, which is a challenge. Some of it is, but most of it not. It gets a bit easier as the 60s progress. So the next book along, because you're starting to get so many Westerns, spy films, lots of spy films coming up, all of this kind of stuff. And they have been released in English, partially because in Spain as well, the opening up of the market in the early 60s meant that Spanish film basically had to start looking outwards. So films in the early 60s tended to be aimed at a Spanish audience, and they never got a release abroad. So they didn't have English language versions or anything like that. So, you know, with the Westerns and other genres, Spain opened up in the 60s, tourism came in, you got your first films with bikinis in them, massive, massive moment in Spanish cinema, the first bikini, El Sombra.
Really?
Yeah. That's, and then...
Would be her.
Of course. And then, you know, they started making films that people would want to see abroad. And that's when you started having English language prints. And so it is easier to get those. And you started having very classy films made.
So what's your plan then for this first volume is 1960 to 64.
Yep.
Have you got a map already laid out of future books?
So I'm working on 65 to 69. So it's basically 5-year intervals.
Okay.
So that's the next one, which I'm working on at the moment. I'm going to see whether I wanted to go straight into the early 70s one or take a break and do something else for a while. But I do love, I am, the more I watch them, the more I love the Spanish stuff. So I am, and the early 70s is really interesting. So I might, but I wouldn't mind doing something back in Italy, for a while.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, I'm starting to tentatively do something on a completely different period of time and country, which is a similar approach, but for British films in the 2000s, which, again, I think is a similarly unexplored territory in many ways, because there's so much stuff released and most of it's just drifted away. No one knows about it anymore.
And it's 20 years ago now, so
it's 20 years
it's
ago.
Old.
It's old, you know. This is the age. Yeah, when when I first watched Bird with the Crystal Plumage, I must have first watched that in about 88, something like that. So it was 16 years old. Wow. No, sorry, it was nearly, 20 years old, roughly 20 years old. So not too far off, which is quite depressing. But
happens to us all.
So that's the other one I'm kind of tentatively starting as well. So there's a few things on. I suspect I'll be doing these Spanish books until I die, and I'll still only be up to about 1990 or something like that.
The trouble is they'll keep making films.
Trouble is with Spanish films, they're making so bloody many of them at the moment. Yeah. You know, while poor old Italy's still in the doldrums in cinema, Spain is absolutely cracking it. And Netflix, this is the amazing thing, is on Netflix, people are watching, Money Heist is one of the biggest sellers on Netflix, a Spanish TV series. What the hell? Netflix are making 50 Spanish films at the moment, all for broadcast on Netflix. I mean, it's amazing. It is like the 60s.
It's great, isn't it? Funnily enough, I've been having this conversation with my students this week because everyone's talking about Squid Game. Netflix has really sort of opened up world cinema and world television and made it mainstream in a way that it just never has been before. The best we could hope for was Channel 4 putting on some kind of Scandi drama that a few people might watch. But now we've got things like Korean shows or Spanish shows being in the top 10 most watched in the country. It's really quite an amazing time.
It's a bit like the days of the video stores when, people weren't able to see E.T., so they'd get out whatever Italian sci-fi film was about. But you'd end up, that's how we all stumbled on this stuff. And it is a bit like that, because you're going into essentially a storefront and you're stumbling on all this weird stuff and people are watching things that they'd never have watched otherwise, which is fascinating.
I mean, I used to mainly watch things like Hammer films and stuff like that. That's what I grew up watching. And I think that's how I first discovered Italian Gothic horror. But I didn't know it was Italian Gothic horror. I just thought it was in the same sort of world as Hammer. So I think I probably saw Mask of Satan and stuff like that, not really knowing it wasn't British at all, because it all felt like I was in the same Gothic world. It's fabulous to suddenly, what would be even better, of course, is if Netflix was also showing us old stuff too.
Yes, that's what you need Prime for.
Exactly. all kinds of weird old crap turns up on Amazon Prime. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
They've got a lot of weird stuff. But anyway, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your books. I've been actually trying to track you down and contact you for a long time. So I'm glad that we've finally been able to have this conversation. And then for it to turn out that you live just down the road from me is even funnier.
There's a little kind of European trash film kind of community in here. Well,
and so if people want to buy your books, where is the best place to
Amazon.
Go and find them?
So, just go onto Amazon. It's all available there.
I mean, I said if people want to buy your books. What I meant was when people want to buy your books.
Absolutely.
Where do they go?
Of course.
So thanks everybody for listening, and we will be back shortly with a mini season of Italian Decameron based movies. That's the plan. We're doing the
Decameroticans.
I've seen them called Decameroticans, Decamerici. All sorts of things. But anyway, that's coming up next. And the problem with those films is most of them don't have English subtitles. So that's going to be really fun. But it's mostly just people running around with no clothes on. So I don't know how much we need to understand anyway. But anyway, we'll have some of those coming out in a couple of weeks. But for now, thank you for listening. Thank you again to Matt Blake. And we'll see you all again soon. Cue the music. Cool. Thank you very much.
Is that all right?
That's great.
Cool.
Perfect.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.